today on Vox Talks Economics, a London economic consensus. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips, and every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember, subscribe, you follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Instagram as well. You find us at, well, Vox Talks Economics. Who would be a policymaker right now? The list of economic problems that we need to solve ranges from very difficult to existential. An ambitious new book collects the ideas of many influential economists on how to approach these challenges, but can it avoid the mistakes of previous attempts to find an economic policy consensus? Andres Velasco and Tim Besley of the London School of Economics are two of the editors of the book The London Consensus, and I'm with them now. So welcome to Vox Talks Economics, Andres.
Thank you.
And welcome, Tim.
Thank you.
About what is the London Consensus a consensus? What are you finding a consensus of?
Well, unlike the Washington Consensus, which inevitably has been the main point of comparison, we're not seeking to create a recipe book of policies that are going to guide every country around the world, but we are trying to seek a set of policy principles or economic principles, if you like, that can guide policy so that each country can be empowered to find a bespoke solution to the particular challenges that it faces. So in that sense, the consensus is about the kind of economic ideas that we think have been tested, tried in different contexts, and can be brought together to solve problems. We think that's what economics is in fact about. Economics isn't a recipe book of policies. It's a way of thinking and analyzing problems that, if done well, really can provide insights that can inform policy.
Recipes are typically bad economics because one principle may be applied in different ways and imply different policies in country X, Y, or Z. Recipe books are typically about politics as well. And in the book, we emphasize politics and political economy a lot. One thing we learned in the 35 years since the Washington Consensus is that top-down policymaking, particularly when mandated from Washington, is not very effective. Because if a policy has no local ownership, it typically lacks legitimacy. When the government changes, the policy goes out the window. And if you understand today, a policy may not be around next year, well, you're not going to follow the directions of that policy, and therefore the policy will be entirely ineffective. In fact, it could even be counterproductive. So we're trying to stay away as much as possible from the Ten Commandments or from the shopping list, and rather trying to organize people's thinking so that governments and countries can choose freely and, we hope, democratically.
This is a massively ambitious project. I'm looking at the book. It's about 600 pages long. Whose idea was this?
Well, I think I've got to defer to my colleague here, Andres. It was he who first came with the idea, but you attributed, Andres, if I recall, to a taxi ride we had together where we started thinking about this.
Indeed.
Is that right?
Tim and I had a taxi ride going home. We actually live in the same bit of West London. And having had a dinner at the LSE with colleagues and maybe a glass of wine or two, we thought, okay, well, how can we translate the research that very bright people do around this university into something that is, in fact, useful out there in the world? You mentioned who would want to be a policymaker in your introduction. Well, I used to be a policymaker. Mm-hmm. When I became one, I had black hair and I came out with white hair. Clearly, being a policymaker is not easy. One reason why it's not easy is that policymakers are very busy people. They have no time to craft grand plans. But when they have 10 minutes of freedom and they run into people like Tim or like me, the typical question is, so what are you economists in academia doing that is of use to me? But don't give me a paper to read. I don't have the time for that. Try to translate that research into something which I could discuss at a cabinet meeting or where my team could put together a plan. So that's the idea behind this book. It assembles research carried out by some of the leading economists in the LSE and elsewhere. And the question we asked each one of them was very simple. What is it that in your subfield we have learned in the 35 years since the Washington Consensus was launched? So if you do international trade or labor and gender or fiscal policy, pick your favorite subject. What is it that we know today that we didn't know back then? And how could this be helpful?
You've already remarked on the quality of the people we have, but we approached them, and so many of them gave us a close to instantaneous yes. Uh-huh. Not only that, with a lot of help from our other excellent co-editor, Irena Bocelli, we've actually got them to deliver.
Prodding along the way, but not too much.
But also to write in a form that does have some background in economics would help to understand it, but basically is communicating to a general audience. So yeah, that was part of the conception early on. But I suppose when we started out on this journey, we weren't sure whether we were going to get people like the ones we asked to buy in, but we did. And we think that signals that, first of all, the economics profession is open to the idea that we want to demonstrate the relevance of our work, which is very cheering for those of us who've made our careers in that, but also that there are ideas coming out of research that are deeply relevant. And I think that was the natural way to proceed, given the ambition. And we got to the finish line, and now we hope others will benefit from reading what these different authors said.
We've mentioned the Washington Consensus a couple of times already. Now, some of our audience will post-date the Washington Consensus, so we better explain exactly what that was and how successful or unsuccessful it turned out to be.
First, a bit of history. The Washington Consensus came out of an academic conference that took place in Washington in late 1989 to place what policymakers in Washington were thinking about at that point. The late 80s were the time when capital mobility across borders had exploded. So a lot of countries doing a great deal of borrowing, and many countries had gotten in trouble because they had too much debt, particularly countries in my part of the world. You may remember there was something called the Latin American debt crisis of the 80s, which was systemic, as we economists like to say, meaning that it didn't just make a difference in Latin America. You know, the big American banks were very much worried about this because they had billions and billions and billions on the line. So the main concern of that conference was, how do we avoid this kind of very dangerous macroeconomic instability from recurring? And at the time, they said things which were somewhat controversial. Most of that wisdom, or at least part of that wisdom, I think is still applicable, very much apropos of the current British debate. How much debt is too much debt? What kind of a fiscal deficit is reasonable? If you want to do a fiscal adjustment, how do you do it, et cetera, et cetera? But the Washington Consensus left many issues unanswered or even not even considered, right? To some extent, because there was much less awareness of the political economy of policy, but also because many of the things we worry about today were not even around back then. For instance, in the last 35 years, we've learned a lot about how it is that you ignite economic growth. We're very lucky to have among the authors in the book one of our colleagues who won the Nobel Prize last month. Mm-hmm. And his contribution, along with his co-authors, is very much one in which they tell us, you know, what it takes to grow. And it's about innovation, and it's about the incentives to innovation. And you invest in innovation when you think you may seize a big fat rent next year. But if those rents get too fat, then the innovators get too powerful. Think of tech oligarchs in the US, and maybe they begin to stifle competition. So it's a very delicate balance between innovation and the incentives to innovation on the one hand, and they need to be competitive, transparent on the other. These kinds of things are the kinds of things that economists have been thinking about in the last quarter century. This was simply not on the table back then. And a bunch of other issues which today are crucial. We think of climate change, of equity in the labor market and gender dynamics, of issues of social inclusion and the politics that comes with it all. You know, the threat that liberal democracy finds itself under, the rise of populism, left wing and right wing. All of these were 21st century concerns. And you could not find any thoughts about this back in the Washington Consensus. We do hope the London Consensus has something to say about all of this.
Now, you mentioned Philippe Aguillon's work there. Another economist who has contributed a lot to the debate recently, Danny Roderick, you quote him in the introduction as saying, "Beware of economists bearing paradigms." Does he have a point?
Well, I think he has a real point. We wanted to engage with that discussion and debate, and at least to try and therefore locate the contribution of this project, while still having some level of healthy skepticism for simplistic economics that can be distilled paradigmatically. People will often use terms in economics like, oh, this is neoclassical economics, or this is, heaven forbid, neoliberal economics or whatever. And all of these things are just labels, and no one really says what they believe. We're fully imbibed with the idea of being somewhat skeptical about it. But we do also think, though, that there's value in trying to step back and think, are there some contours that can be identified within the landscape that are useful to communicate and I suppose would add up to something like a, could be called a paradigm. We subscribe to the idea that narratives are very important in communicating economics. So another way perhaps of thinking about this is there a narrative that links together a set of different ideas? So one of the narratives in our consensus is how you bring politics and economics together, that you cannot think of good economics that does not at least pay close attention to what is the political feasibility of that economic project. What kind of political institutions do you need to deliver it? I don't know whether that's a paradigm or not, but it's a joining together of thinking so that we aren't having just pockets of disparate knowledge, but something that feels more joined up. I share Danny's broad skepticism. At the same time, there is value in the exercise, I think.
I think that's absolutely right. We're delighted that Danny joined this project. I was lucky enough to be in the same school as he is at the Kennedy School for many, many years. So we had this conversation. And I think Danny would say paradigms are dangerous when they are exactly what Tim was describing, sort of an oversimplification. Uh-huh. That you come up with two or three very basic ideas. You come up with a label, neoliberal, neo this or neo that. And you think that that is a sufficient basis for crafting policy. And that's clearly not the case. If you take that approach, it's going to be one size fits all. It's not going to be very useful. But on the other hand, to go back to the idea of narratives, you know, what I learned in my life as a minister and a politician is that you go on an interview like this and quoting 27.5 statistics is not going to give you very far. People mm-hmm. want to be told, well, how do these numbers hang together? What is the logic? What's going on? Tell me a story. We know from colleagues in brain science and psychology, the human brain is wired to react much better to stories than it is to disparate facts. So what is the narrative that is woven together here? I'm not sure we've gotten to the point where we can boil it down to one pithy sentence. But for instance, the idea of thinking of growth in a different way, the idea that politics and economics are inseparable, the idea that you need a very capable state, and that the kinds of policies that you should pursue depend on how able your state is. It's pretty broad ideas, and I think they help us organize our thinking.
When we last spoke to Tim Leslie, it was about how governments can inspire trust. And it turns out there's one easy to measure, but very hard to achieve way to do that. If we live through a period of economic growth, it inspires a lifelong faith in us, in policymakers. And of course, the opposite. Listen to Growth and Trust in Government from May 2025.
You have distilled these narratives down to some core principles.
Yeah, we've already hinted at them actually in the discussion we've had, but let's bring it all into daylight. So our first principle is that you have to look beyond the purely materialistic view of what makes life important, that it's not mm-hmm. all about the money, it's about well-being. And that encompasses a number of strands of thinking in modern economics without necessarily subscribing to a narrow view about what well-being is, but recognizing that things like status and dignity, these are important human values, and the economy and society and the polity are central to promoting those.
One question that everybody is being asked is what explains the rise of populism, mm-hmm. not just in countries that do very badly economically, but in rich, successful countries in the West where democracy has been consolidated for centuries. One explanation, not the only one, is that there are people in regions where it's not simply that they're less rich than the rest of the country, but they feel left behind in terms of the words that Tim was using, respect, consideration, identity, recognition. You know, people in the Midwest of the United States feel that the elites in New York and San Francisco don't pay any attention to them. They look down on them. The phrase fly over country, you get in a jet, you take off from Kennedy, land in Los Angeles, and you simply look down on these poor people in the Midwest and declining towns, the Rust Belt. That sort of attitude is bad politically, is unfair, but also breed bad economics. Because it does not take into account that people care about a bunch of things in addition to their wages, their employment, their consumption. And that opens up, for instance, a discussion about what some people are calling place-based policies. Should we really worry about what happens in a town where the jobs leave, where the able young people cannot find jobs and they leave too, and a really bad social and economic multiplier sets in which social ills, drug addiction, crime, etc., rise, That's a real problem. It's a problem in the US and the UK, but it's also a problem in Spain and in Brazil and, you know, pick your favorite country. And we have not had an approach that helped us think about systematically. And that's what our first principle is about.
Andres, when we were brainstorming about the five principles, I remember you came up with this wonderful idea. It's where you produce, what you produce, and how you produce it matter. Mm-hmm. That's a nice one-liner, which we think encapsulates many of the ideas that Andres has tried to articulate.
And again, to land that, most policies today tell people to go where the jobs are. I was in a meeting yesterday with a bunch of our students who presented a paper about Jakarta. I learned yesterday that Jakarta is the largest metropolitan region, metropolitan area in the world, and 42 million people. The average resident of Jakarta spends 3 hours going back and forth from work.
Wow.
And so if the jobs are in one part of Jakarta and the working class population lives at the other end of the city, well-being cost of being stuck in traffic for 3 hours, the pollution, the congestion, the noise, the inability of people to see their own families, the waste in every possible sense is gigantic. Why have we built cities in which people have to spend 3 hours stuck in traffic, you know, in order to get to work? Why can't we think about the location of people and the location of jobs in a way that is more sensible? That's the sort of conversation that we'd like to have.
We're very well aware that using GDP as a measure is insufficient to be able to make these policies. We are a little bit short of reliable measures that would form a basis for policy, though, are we not?
Yeah, I think we are. But what I don't think I would favour, and again, I can't speak for others in the project, is that there will be a simple alternative metric. Uh-huh. I think the way we think our principle would be used is when you're having a discussion, say, about certain kinds of development policies, that you would look at the impact of that on people's lives in different ways. And you wouldn't expect then, oh, we'll add all those different ways up and then come out with a number and that will tell us if this is a good or a bad policy. I just think it's making sure that the discussion that takes place around any specific policy gets outside a narrow view that just says, well, if people have higher incomes, that must be a better way to run the world. I know that's a caricature of probably what most people do. I wouldn't want to say there's only one good way to depart from that, that every conversation will be different, depend on the culture and history of a country. We wouldn't want to say in this country with this particular background culture, you have to think about it this way. I'm reminded of an example, actually, when we did our Fragile States Commission here at the LSE many years ago, and we spoke to one of the new ministers who'd come in Tunisia at the time of the Arab Spring. And of course, the international organizations were telling them to do very conventional economic things to try and get the economy going.
Yeah.
But the thing they came up with was cleaning the mosques, because they wanted to build trust with their citizens, because
right.
they felt at the time, if they were going to bring in successful policy reform, they needed to build trust first. So again, that's thinking about the culture of that society and what made sense at the time. So a broader conversation about the nature of what matters in economic policy, we think, can only be healthy to get to better policy solutions.
One of the problems that all policymakers face today is lack of credibility, because there's a growing separation between the sort of policy elites and the professional politicians and the voters. And this is true, again, across the world, in East and West, North and South. And one big question then is, how is it that politicians and bureaucrats and policymakers restore those bonds of trust? It's not sufficient to say, well, you have a 10% raise and you'll make more than last year. That's not going to do it. It has to do precisely with issues like, do I respect your culture? If you happen to be a devout Muslim, well, let me show you that I understand where you're coming from. The fact that we talk about well-being and a broader definition of people's aspirations is not tantamount to saying that economic growth or GDP are meaningless. On the contrary, we're not endorsing some sort of degrowth strategy. And let me make that point by mentioning that our second principle is that economic growth remains very important, which in some circles may sound like it's something obvious, but it is less obvious than it sounds for at least two reasons. The first one is that if we go back to the Washington consensus surprisingly didn't have much to say about growth.
Huh.
Again, it's typically derided as something that was neoliberal, so immediately you might make the connection, no, neoliberals are all about growth and GDP. But in fact, they had a very narrow definition of what we were trying to accomplish. Again, go back at the Latin American debt crisis. The other thing that's going on back then is, of course, the end of the Soviet Empire and the liberalization in Eastern Europe. So people like Jeff Sachs go to Poland, and the first thing that they say, well, you know, there are all these price controls are entirely crazy. Liberalize the prices and let prices, you know, do their thing and signal scarcity and all those things that we economists think about. And of course, we would not be against that. The price system is very important. It sends signals. It matters a great deal for allocation. But what we know, and the last 35 years very clearly reminded us of this lesson, is that that is the first step in igniting growth, but that's not the end of the story. Mm-hmm. It's not simply enough to say, well, get the government out of people's businesses, let the government liberalize the price system, and then automatically you will grow. There are many countries that followed that idea, liberalize their economies, and they've been stagnating. Some of them are in Africa, some of them are in the Middle East, many are in Latin America. How is it that once you liberalize an economy, you ensure that there will be innovation, productivity gains, and all of that? Growth turns out to be more difficult and more complicated than we thought. And that's where our second principle aims to add something to the conversation.
Policymakers confront very difficult challenges. If you're doing that in the context of a stagnant economy,
yeah,
those challenges just become right. more difficult. So unless we make a serious effort to promote growth and to find an ecosystem that can deliver growth, we are going to get increasingly stuck in a world of close to zero-sum politics.
Yeah. Where and as we're learning in the UK today, getting growth going involves more than simply saying, we want growth. Mm-hmm. It is not a matter of will. And it's quite striking how many governments, including the UK government, are finding it very hard to come up with a three-point playbook. These are the three or four things that we're going to do to get growth going in the next 3 or 4 years. And you see that same debate playing out in many places. You know, in the EU is another place where growth is stagnant, and EU policymakers don't seem to have a clear playbook of what to do. My region of the world, Latin America, followed the Washington Consensus, liberalized the economies. You had a growth spurt that lasted for about 5 years. And then since then, most economies are growing very little. So getting growth on the books and having a playbook to ignite growth is harder than it sounds, even in rich economies like the UK.
Is there something that economists know about how to generate growth now that hasn't filtered through to policy yet? Because it is the first priority of a government policymaker is to generate growth. And as you say, worldwide, it's anemic.
There's an old-fashioned view of growth that still dominates, that sees the kind of capital output ratio as the sine qua non of growth. And what we know now, it's structural transformation. We're living through a period with new technologies that are going to change the nature of our economy. And to say that we're going to have more or less capital as a way of thinking about that is just not correct. We do need investment. We need investment to create that change. But you need to be creating in such a way as you're taking advantage of the latest and best technologies. And that is a difficult incentive problem. It's the one that is at the heart of Aguillon and Howitt's Nobel Prize winning work. To understand, you create those incentive structures, you make sure that the incumbents are not too powerful to resist entry, but at the same time, there are sufficient profits on the table to inspire those who are going to come in into the sector. But to narrow that down to some measure of capital formation as the target of policy, I sometimes think it's like, well, you could advise somebody who aspires to win an Olympic running medal to tell them, I've got the secret, you just run faster. And a lot of growth policy can sound just like that. You just invest more. But you know, that's not super helpful. You've got to think about those structural policies, the nature of the economy you want to create, and how government can be supportive in creating
that. On that last point, if I may, how government can be supportive, one thing that we have also learned is that governments don't just provide generic inputs. The Washington Consensus is very much about generic inputs, a little defense, a little stability, pick up the rubbish, and then growth happens. We know today that governments provide things that are very much tailored to a particular business in a particular sector. And that sector, parenthetically, need not be manufacturing. Too many politicians are still stuck on the idea that if you don't make things that, you know, have steel in them, you're not quite doing the right thing.
Yes.
I'll give you one example. Tim and I are employed by an institution that is a big exporter in the United Kingdom. It's called the educational sector. We very much rely on a bunch of things that the United Kingdom's government does for education generally. We need a system of visas that allows our students to get here. We need certifications that our students can say, my degree can be used in India or in Brazil once I graduate from here. Of course, you know, students will come here if they feel safe and if they feel welcome. It helps if you have a system so that they can stay here for a year and maybe get some training before they go back home. But this is an export sector. It's an incredibly dynamic export sector, and it's an export sector that lives from a collaboration that grows if and only if there is a collaboration between the government providing some of these very specialized inputs and the private sector. In this case, we are the private sector. The same is applicable to so many other industries. Think of finance, of course, the big service industry in the City of London. You cannot have a leading financial sector unless you have incredibly sophisticated and sector-specific regulation. And the reason why London and New York have that and most other countries of the world don't is that you don't have the institutional setup that would allow you to trade bonds and all kinds of securities. And that view of the government as a partner providing specialized inputs and not the government as the enemy, I think, is very much something that today we understand was not clear 25, 30 years ago.
You also refer to the government, though, as the insurer of last resort. What does that mean? Was that influenced by the financial crisis, that feeling of what government has to be?
Our third principle has to do with countering volatility or uncertainty. All of us like our lives to be predictable and safe, so we don't like big shocks. And the question is, what are the shocks? What are the sources of the shocks? And what can policy do about it? The Washington Consensus worried about one kind of volatility, which was the one that was paramount in people's minds back in 1990. That was debt and fiscal and monetary instability. That's still important, of course. But we have learned in the years since, I mean, we should have known all along that there are other kinds of shocks. You can have a financial shock that then threatens the rest of the economy. That's what happened in the world financial crisis 15, 20 years ago. You can have a health shock. We went through the biggest one ever 5 years ago. You can have a shock to prices because a dictator called Putin invades a country next door and suddenly people's gas bills in the UK go up by 50 or 80%. Governments can play a role in countering the effects of those shocks. As you pointed out, in the financial crisis of 07, 08, governments stepped in to prevent financial markets from seizing. They bought equity in certain banks. They provided emergency loans. Or during the pandemic in this country, there was a furlough scheme that was very successful in making sure that firms would not have to fire everybody and lose what people call organizational capital. So yes, we believe that there's a role for government to do that, and government is doing that. The catch, however, is that the reason why government can do that in bad times is that the government can borrow. And our colleague Ricardo Reis likes to speak of what he calls the special nature of public debt. Public debt is a very delicate and very important and beautiful thing. Governments can typically borrow at lower rates than the private sector. And governments typically in countries like the UK or the US have unfettered access to capital markets, even in bad times. But that's a sort of tree that you have to water every day, because if it dies, it's very hard to revive. So how do you do that? Well, you borrow in bad times and you repay in good times. So you have an expansionary fiscal policy during the downswing, but you need a more contractionary fiscal policy in good times during the upswing. And that second bit is something that too many people forget about.
But it is something that we have known for many, many years. This isn't new to this document at all, is it?
It is new in one sense. And I get a little boring and technical here. The standard role for fiscal policy has been what you might call macro stabilization, what Keynes might have called, you know, stabilizing the level of aggregate demand. That we've known at least since the general theory in 1936. This is a little bit different because you're not simply offsetting these aggregate shocks. You may be offsetting shocks to individual households. Some guy was in some business and that business was made obsolete by technological innovation. There will be some transitional period. You cannot buy insurance against that. You cannot diversify that risk away. And therefore, can the government provide insurance for that sort of thing? We think the answer is yes. Private markets don't sell you insurance against Putin invading Ukraine or against China invading Taiwan, which of course would have massive economic consequences for every household in this country or any other country. So yes, this is new. It's a different kind of insurance against a different kind of shock.
Another domain where there's definitely unfinished business is dealing with social care and old age. A few governments now are really providing, I think, signature policies that show that they're on top of this, but that's a rarity. There's a big difference, as we probably can all reflect our own lifetime experiences with people we've known, between those who age well and those who age poorly, in the sense of having lots of challenges as they age. and you need a system that is responsive to both profiles. And so a policy around that can be thought of as a form of government insurance that the private sector will never effectively be able to.
We don't know how long we will live, right?
Yeah. And we really don't think that it's realistic to say a market economy can deliver that without some level of government intervention to pool risks. We certainly didn't invent that point. It's been known for a while, but it's now become much clearer, partly with an aging population, that governments are having to find a solution to that.
You call politics the great enabler. Now, this seems to me a bit of a hard sell at the moment. I mean, you also write in the introduction that the catalogue of political ills is long and worrying. How can politics be an enabler at the moment?
Well, you've touched a raw nerve here. So let me turn a little bit of a criticism on, I will say, a typical economist's view of politics, which is to say, you know, we have a view about the right way to run the world and we'll design all the policies to get us there. All we need is those pesky politicians to get out of the way and let us run the world. A kind of platonic guardian view of economists. We know for lots of reasons that that view of the world looks not particularly inaccurate because it requires giving a lot of power to people to resist, for example, what people want. The great challenge in democracy is to balance principles, judicial oversight, and to guard us against some abuses, both of government and fellow citizens, and not just to follow what citizens want to do. So without thinking about that right balance of getting a governance structure that will serve the people, be responsive to the people, economists are just offering solutions without proper answers. So why is politics the enabler? Because that is the process that we have evolved as collectively over many centuries to sit down and try and resolve our common interests. And politics works well when citizens, not necessarily sort of sitting around the campfire, although in tribal societies, that's how they did it. But in modern societies, we've created representative institutions in liberal democracies whose job it is to try and look at the problems of the day and reach a collective position on those. Sometimes it doesn't work so well, but it's not because politics has failed. It's because we aren't necessarily looking at the right institutions for resolving it. Maybe we need to modernize our institutions to change the way we did it. A good example from history is central bank independence. We learned that having too much politics in determining interest rates and fighting inflation had problems. So we evolved a system of accountable but independent central banks to resolve that. We're always looking for better solutions for collective choice, and that's the enabling side of it. That's when politics enables.
Politics is tough, but the alternative is much tougher. What we call politics is a peaceful way of settling disagreements. If we don't do it peacefully, the alternative is people with guns. I grew up in a country which used to have a democracy and lost its democracy. And let me tell you, democracy is really fun. And you appreciate that when you don't have the democracy. Now, is democracy perfect? Are all the rules of the game as good as they could be? Of course they're not. I think Tim's point. One area where economists can join hands with political scientists and constitutional lawyers and others is thinking, okay, what are the rules that are fine and we should keep them as they are? And what are the rules of politics that I need improving? But to be able to tackle that question, you have to think of politics as an opportunity, not simply politics as a nightmare or a constraint.
To finish your list of core principles, you're talking about state capacity. Is there a consensus on what state capacity is?
We think of there being three broad areas of state capacity, which we think are relevant in pretty much every country that's trying to deliver for its citizens. One is the capacity to raise tax revenue, because you can't do much unless you've got resources to do it with. The system of regulation and law that enables a market economy to thrive, which we think is an essential dimension. And then the third is, once you've raised those revenues and got a functioning market economy, you have to decide on the priorities for the citizens. And that we call collective capacity, the capacity to deliver health services, education, whatever it is, a pension system that works effectively and efficiently. Yes. So I would say those three dimensions of state capacity are essential. It's something we've come to understand, I think, a lot better.
But Tim, is there a standard toolkit for building that state capacity?
I would resist the idea of thinking of it in terms of a toolkit, because it comes back to our conversation just now about politics. Where do you begin? You begin with a collective belief we want to solve a problem. Only then do you then start to talk about the technical issues that involve doing that. So we might want to build a bridge over a particular river, but we have to reach the conclusion that would be the bridge we want. We can then bring in the engineers and the other experts to tell us how to build a bridge and connect it to the road network and do all the stuff we need to do. And so I think there is a technical side of building state capacity. And there's huge numbers of people running around the world advising countries about how to improve their tax systems and legal systems and so forth. But I would say if it's not anchored in the political will, that's doomed to fail. The other thing I would say is the culture and history of any specific country really matters. There's no one size fits all. Think of the challenge of raising tax revenue. There are certain norms and customs about the kinds of taxes that citizens have grown used to paying in some places. And it would be strange if you didn't build on those norms and customs when you were designing a tax system. So there's plenty of ways to do this that should be reflective of a national conversation or even an international conversation about it. But I would resist the idea that we just call in McKinsey and they'll tell us how to build better states.
Yeah.
Indeed, I'd say that's a dangerous idea. Yeah.
Economists have discovered at least two big things in the last 50 years. One is politics, and the other is culture. What Tim is saying is that the political culture of a country matters a lot. And that's bad news and good news. The bad news is, of course, that the culture moves slowly. So you don't wake up one morning and decide, I will have the political culture of Britain or Denmark. You have whatever political culture you inherited. But culture, of course, is not written in stone. Culture evolves. There are countries where political institutions and political culture and people's willingness not to cross certain boundaries and do certain things may have been unthinkable 100 years ago, but they're feasible today because they become part of the way we do things. So politicians write budgets and pass laws, but politicians also shape the political culture. And we academics can help politicians think about how it is that you build that culture.
One of the advantages of the Washington Consensus is you could write it down on a piece of paper. There's 100,000 undergraduate essays that did exactly that. This is a very large book. How do you operationalize it?
This is exactly the challenge that we're currently facing. I mean, we obviously are biased in believing there's so much good content in the book. There's probably no policymaker in the world that wouldn't get some value from it. Of course, that's a very grand claim, but yeah, I believe it to be true. Of narrow ambition is to get more people reading it. And I should stress that it's an open access publication. Anyone anywhere in the world can access it for free. And we hope, therefore, that people will read it. But beyond that, of course, there's a much bigger challenge is having read it and absorbed the ideas and debated the ideas. We don't think we have a monopoly on wisdom any more than anyone else does. They'll feel empowered, if you like, by having these ideas at their disposal to be tackling some of the major policy challenges they face. So that's the next phase of this. It becomes a conversation that will be had around the world and informed by the book. And that would be, for us, a huge measure of success.
And different people in different parts of the world may find this bit or that bit more useful. I'll give you two examples. Tim and I have gone around the world trying to promote this book, and we've launched the book in the US and in Brussels and in India and in South America. And I've learned a lot from those conversations. We did a launch at a very prominent think tank in Brussels. There was a discussion. We had a couple of people who made comments about the book, and then we had a lunch. And much of the discussion at lunch was, well, the big issue today in the European Union is security and institutions for, say, purchasing weapons have to be revamped. And so what kind of state capacity is needed there? I don't think Tim and I had defense or security as a priority when we were thinking about state capacity, but suddenly an application of this principle becomes very important. So, you know, we had a conversation of how is it that you should, in fact, purchase weapons in, you know, a continent-sized union like the EU, and what are reasonable rules, and what should each country do? What's centralized? What's decentralized? Who decides what? What do we know from the literature in state capacity and in literature about the political economy institutions that may be helpful in this connection? Then last week I was in Buenos Aires, where, of course, you know, the economy is often teetering on the verge of macro disaster. Mm-hmm. And somebody made a comment which I thought was brilliant. And he said, this economy will have to grow. And when we turn to growth, we will have to think about the London Consensus, But today, the first priority is stabilization. So maybe we start in Washington and then we travel to London. And I thought that was pretty good. Different countries, different needs, different urgencies. But ideally, the book can be useful in those very, very varied circumstances.
One of the criticisms of the Washington consensus, of course, was it was people from rich countries telling people from other countries how to run their economies and being deaf to the contexts. When you look at the people who have written the London Consensus, they are based in institutions in America and Europe. And if I was a policymaker in an emerging market, developing economy, I might say, well, you've got enough problems of your own to sort out before you start telling us how to run our countries.
Let me take that up because I've thought a lot about this. The title may suggest that because it uses two words that may be controversial. One is consensus, we talked about already. And somebody might say, why London? You know, it's another rich city in the north. We chose that title for obvious reasons, because I think the parallel with the Washington Consensus 35 years ago is useful. But more fundamentally, where people are based is not what's fundamental. The question is, what kinds of issues do these authors study and where do these authors come from? I did take the time to do the counting. Nearly half of the authors, in fact, were born in emerging or developing countries, including me. And so we do not think of this as a bunch of people in the north trying to tell the world what to do. On the contrary, you know, we've talked about Danny Roderick. He's from Turkey, the guy doing export-led growth. Ricardo Hausmann is from Venezuela. Some of the work on environment is done by a colleague who's from Nigeria, and the list goes on and on.
So what's next for the London Consensus? Where do you take this project from here?
The short term is to get the ideas out there and to show that they can speak to the issues of the day. That will be the test of all of this. So let me give you a concrete example. Many countries are looking at very difficult fiscal positions. And it's an area where there was a playbook that emerged from the Washington Consensus. It came out of a previous episode of that. First best is this is headed off and doesn't happen. But if it does crystallize, that reading the principles in the book, we think one would approach that very differently. So we would look for evidence that when people are deciding how to make fiscal adjustments as needed, that they will pay attention to the principles, that the effect on the polity of that, because some countries are worrying that if they make fiscal adjustments, it will lead to social unrest. So we think that a good test will be when the next policy challenge comes, wherever it comes, that the principles will look like a useful way of thinking through it. There will be no simple mapping from the principles to the answer, but that's the point of what we're saying. But it will still be a useful guidance for that conversation.
Absolutely. And to do that, the conversations can be done online, but they're best done face-to-face. And that's why we're going around the world trying to tell people what's in the book and listening to their reactions.
And that's why we had this conversation face-to-face today. Thank you very much for talking to me about it. Thank you, Andreas and Tim.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If you want to read this, it is called The London Consensus, Economic Principles for the 21st Century. As Tim pointed out, it is open access, so you can download it. Or if you want the paper copy, then you can get that from LSE Press.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week, in our final episode of 2025, has the world been changed forever by the Trump administration?